everyone, and welcome to episode 108 of season 11 of Movie Minute, the daily podcast where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Matthew Simpson of Northern Reel. Welcome back for yet another season, Matthew.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, I always like having you on. You give a nice perspective on things, though. That's always fun.
Oh, thanks.
So let's start with the simple first question of what is your background with Band of Brothers?
I mean, my background is that I watched it when it was new in the, I don't know, actually off the top of my head, remember what year it came out in, but I was...
2001.
Yeah, so I was freshly moved out on my own a year or two before. I initially obtained it through nefarious means and then purchased the tin DVD collector set. And for a long time, I watched it once a year on Remembrance Day. I did that for a long time, actually. I'd have a bunch of people over. We'd have some drinks and some food, and we would just like sit there and shoot the shit
and watch
have Band of Brothers on. And watch all 10 episodes in a day. Yeah.
Wow.
It's always a pretty cool way to spend a day.
Yeah, sure. When is Canadian Remembrance Day?
November the 11th.
Oh, okay. So it's Armistice Day. Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, it'd be me, and then people would sort of cycle in and cycle out. And we would watch, I would watch at least all 10 episodes. I did that for several years into the early 10s before I sort of stopped. Couldn't tell you why. I stopped because it was sort of an event that I would drink a lot at, and then I quit drinking. So that's what stopped it.
Okay.
And then, yeah, now I watch it every couple of years. Sometimes I watch the whole thing. Sometimes I just watch a couple episodes, but I do come back to it every couple of years now.
Okay. All right. So is watching it under the influence very different than watching it not under the influence?
Honestly, watching, it's not so much about being under the influence as it was that, like, when I would do that thing where I'd just watch it all day on Remembrance Day, it was much more of like a social event. So it would sort of be on and we'd be watching it, but we'd also be talking and doing stuff. So now when I watch it, it's more that, like, I'm watching it, if that.
Okay.
I think that makes sense, right? Sitting down and watching it a little bit more purposefully. As opposed to, like, when you're in there with a bunch of people and you've had a couple of drinks and you definitely like key in on certain parts and you maybe zone out for certain parts. So it's a little less, not the best way to watch something if you've never seen it before, but I have seen it a bazillion times. So I never felt bad doing that.
Right. Okay. No, that makes sense. It's, I've done the same thing with I guess the Die Hard movies, with the Star Wars movies, with Back to the Future. I mean, you have all these movies that you've seen so many times that, you know, even if you're walking in and out, you still know what's going on, you know, that type of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, perfect sense. All right. So, first of all, I want to apologize for you getting a little shortchanged that this first episode will only be a little less than 2 minutes. So you don't get the full 5 minutes here, but you still do get the... tag end of part 8. So, you know, there's something to that also.
Yeah, and honestly, it's a good 2 minutes of TV, so that's fine. Yes,
That is true. So, episode 108 begins with Winters offering to drive and ends with the end credits of part 8. So we ended things yesterday with Winters getting his new rank insignia. Nixon just hands it off to him, and he looks at it in a very strange way, as if, in some ways he's completely surprised that he's actually moving up even more now. You know,
they very unceremoniously handed to him.
Right.
By Ron Livingston just being like, oh, you're wearing the wrong rank insignia, basically, and just tosses it at him.
Yeah.
And, I think that strikes me as a combination of, like, oh, I'm a major now, and also, like, why is it happening this way?
Right. You know? That's true. But you see, I look at it also from the perspective that Winters is sort of saying to himself, that, you know, I don't necessarily deserve to be here. And I think he's also looking at it from the perspective that this action will move him even further away from the men that he loves.
Yeah, for sure. And that comes up in a later episode, which I'm sure you'll touch on.
Yeah.
Where I think at this point he's already fired his gun for the last time.
Yes. When he shot the German kid, you know, in the I'm trying to remember the name of it. Or was, you know, when they're at the crossroads, that's what it was. It's been a while.
Yeah, yeah. So I think he's realizing that, like, he's moving not just away from the being around the men that he loves, but around being in the same sort of peril as the men he's commanding.
Right.
And I feel like that might come with at least a small amount of guilt, you know, like, you know, so he's sort of surprised at being promoted. He's a little bit, maybe guilt is the wrong word, but certainly feeling a little bit like I'm going to be sending these men into peril, not going with them into peril. And I bet that has a real sort of soldier's guilt aspect to it as well.
Right. Yeah. And there's also, I mean, as we all saw at the end of, you know, part seven, when, you know, when Dyke is fiddling around and doesn't know what to do, you know, he himself starts running towards the men to go help them until Sink, you know, screams at him in front of everybody and pulls him back, you know, that type of thing. You know, he's having trouble with the fact that he's moving up in the ranks and, as you said, not being able to be there in the thick of things with the men that he has grown to love over almost 3 years at this point. You know, so yeah, it's a great look, and Damian Lewis just plays this character so well. You know, as much as I love Damian Lewis in Homeland, I think this is his best role that he's ever done. Yeah.
And it's certainly the one that put him on the map, right?
Oh, for like, sure.
I mean, to be fair, Band of Brothers is the thing that put lots of people on the map.
Yeah.
But this is really the one that, like, put him in particular on the map. Like, Ron Livingston had been around for a little while. You know, lots of, like, Scott Grimes and a few other guys, the more enlisted guys, had sort of been around for a while, at least in America.
Right.
Because Damian Lewis is British. But this was the one, I think maybe the first thing I ever saw him in. And then he's just been around ever since. And if nothing else, the show is a blessing in that, like, there's lots of people who are talented actors who are now famous because of it. And that's a great thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, based on a lot of the conversations that I've had, a lot of the actors, you know, the ones with small parts, the ones with big parts, doesn't make a difference. They bonded so well that even now, 25 years later, they're still all in touch with one another. You know, they still have reunions. They, you know, and it's a very rare thing to see in any, you know, TV or movie, that 25 years later, you have such a vast cast of people that are still, you know, in touch and still getting together and stuff like that. So, you know, to me, it's just amazing to watch that and to see that this is the seedling of that. You know, the fact that these guys all spent 10 months together, you know, making this miniseries, and, you know, that's their, you know, many of them see this as not just their starting point in their careers, but also a very high point in their careers, you know, from that perspective. So at this point, Winters, you know, walks over towards the Jeep and just basically tells the guy who's driving, he goes, no, I'll drive. Move away. And then the shot changes and we see all the men getting ready to get into transports in order to move on to their next place. And we see Webster, you know, the focal point of this particular part, you know, walking through the area of Haganah and just looking at everything that's going on, including looking at you know, Jones basically saying goodbye to people, because, you know, Jones has now been transferred. You know, he's you know, they don't need Tom Hanks' son there anymore. You know, he did enough in one part You don't need to have him anymore. So we see him saying, we see Jones saying goodbye to Malarkey. Goes, Sergeant Malarkey, Malarkey, good luck, sir. And then he turns to Martin and goes, Sergeant Sergeant Martin. He goes, yeah, Lieutenant. He goes, good work. He goes, thank you, sir. Good to have you along. And then then Jones turns to everyone in the transport and he goes, good luck, man. And, you know, again, it's an interesting way that they're doing this here. You know, here you have this new guy who just showed up and, you know, they wanted to move him up. And we talked about this over the last few days, the fact that one of the main reasons that someone like Jones was transferred is because they knew that they were coming to the end of the war and they wanted to have West Point graduates in key points, in key places. You know, they don't necessarily need them in Easy Company. You know, they need them in other places where they're going to be able to be more effective once the war supposedly ends. I mean, obviously, nobody knows exactly when that's going to happen, but the assumption is it's coming soon. You know, that type of thing. And but it's a nice way to do it. And Webster just looks on as Jones is saying all these goodbyes, and he's smiling. And you think that, you know, he's saying to himself, okay, you know, here's a guy who was here just a little bit of time, and he's been accepted very well into the, you know, into Easy Company.
This episode is very, like, I really like the parallel stories of Webster and Jones in this. You know, I think it's earlier in the episode when Webster talks about how, like, he feels like an outsider, even though he had been there on D-Day and at Market Garden. But because he wasn't at the Bulge, he's, like, not really in the group anymore. Mm-hmm. And then Jones being the, you know, the new guy who, I mean, he's basically just there to get some combat experience before he goes on to whatever administrative position he's going to go on to. Right.
Right.
And I feel like that sort of, like, this episode does a pretty good job of illustrating that sort of covenant that, well, for lack of a better way to say it, like, the brotherhood forged by going into these situations together, by going into battle together. And I like that they're both accepted at the end because, you know, obviously the reason they're sort of hard on Webster at first and the new guy both is that, like, they're all combat veterans and they feel like these guys aren't. And once they get in there and sort of show that they can do the job and, you know, be a part of the unit, be effective, then they're sort of immediately accepted into the brotherhood again. I think the episode does a really good job of communicating that. And I do love the sort of, like, the goodbye between Webster and Jones is from, you know, across the yard or whatever it is. And it's sort of an unknown sort of smile and nod. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a really, you know, it's a pretty stereotypical, like, manly acknowledgement. But it works really well in the episode.
Yeah, it really does. Because as you said, the two of them are seen as being very much very similar, even though their backgrounds are very different. And, you know, again, in the end, they were both accepted for what they did. And I like the way that they showed that. And then Webster just keeps moving on and starts walking towards where, you know, getting ready to get onto the transport himself. And then we see, you know, he puts up his duffel bag and then Leavegott looks at him. And actually, you know, gives him a hand, which is another great way of showing that Webster is now being reaccepted into things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
I like the way that it's great.
Yeah. You know, he just says here, and then you know, helps him up because you know, Leavegott was the one who was giving Webster the most crap over the course of the entire. Of this entire part. So it's nice to see that he's also finally accepted him. You know,
and it's just a great example of really, like, economical writing. Like, you know, a lesser film would have Leavegott come up and, like, explain that, like, I'm accepting you back into the fold now. Right. Or, you know, something a little more verbose, but just offering him a hand makes it immediately clear that, like, things have changed. Things are better.
Exactly. And you see, and, also, he smiles at him, you know, it's like, okay, you know, this is great. This is you know, and
I guess you're all right, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And then the transport starts moving with them, and then we get another narration from Webster. And he goes, I wondered if people back home would ever know what it cost the soldiers to win this war. In America, things were already beginning to look like peacetime. The standard of living was on the rise. Racetracks and nightclubs were booming. You couldn't get a hotel room in Miami Beach. It was so crowded. How could anyone ever know of the price paid by these soldiers in terror, agony, and bloodshed if they'd never been to places like Normandy, Bastogne, or Haguenau? So, first of all, it's a great way to end the story of these men, you know. And, you know, as the transport moves by, we see the Jeep with Winters and Nixon go by, and we see a Jeep with MPs drive by, as, you know, everyone's basically leaving Haguenau now. And we see all the mud on the ground, you know, the roads are very muddy, but, you know, these gritty guys are just moving on. And it's a great crane shot also at the end, where the camera moves up and shows us, you know, the town of Haguenau. And then, you know, as the cameras, as we think that everything's being, you know, completely done, we can hear a shell coming in, and we see a whole bunch of soldiers running for cover. And then we see an explosion in one of the buildings in Haguenau, meaning that the Germans are still shelling the area. You know, they haven't given up, despite the fact that you might think that that's what they would be doing. At this point, you know, we get the end crawl from from this particular part, and it says, by the time they left Haguenau, Easy Company's European campaign had taken them from England to France, Holland, and Belgium. And then the text continues running, and they give us a little bit of a preview of what's going to be happening in part 9, and then it says soon they would be entering Germany. So again, it's a nice way to show the progression of things, you know, where things started. You know, you and I have watched this entire series, you know, in one shot, but most people haven't. And especially at the beginning, when this was being shown, you know, two episodes a week for 5 weeks. So most people would look at it and, you know, you might have to, I guess, be a little reminded as to, you know, what was going on and stuff like that. So, you know, I think that it works really well the way that they do that.
Yeah, and I think that the all of that is true, and I really appreciate that the series is not afraid to do something a little more focused. Like, a lot of the episodes are very ensemble driven, and this one is very much like Webster's story.
Yeah.
And much like the next one we're going to talk about is another character's story, I like that these later episodes in particular focus on people for different reasons to explore things that are going on in this latter part of the war.
Yeah.
I think it, because, you know, we all think of the, when we think about World War II or any war, really, we tend to think about things like D-Day and you know, the dropping in behind enemy lines and combat and stuff. But the stuff at the end, when the waning days of the war, are just as impactful. And I feel like this series in particular does a very good job of exploring where these men are at toward the end of the war. I think the Pacific actually does it really well as well, just that showing that these men are going to have a difficult time adjusting back. And I think that this episode is a great sort of first step towards that part of the story about, like, how will these men ever come back to the world?
Right.
And I think it's pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Pacific went one step further and really showed the brutalness of how the soldiers acted, and also how everything affected them, stuff like that. I mean, you have the whole thing with Eugene Sledge, but you know, that his father was trying to keep him from going, and he ended up deciding to go. And, you know, when he came back, he was a wreck because of it. You know, it makes you think that he's saying to himself, you know, maybe I should listen to my father, you know, that type of thing. But, you know, the way that war affects different people. And, you know, the Pacific showed more of the brutality than they show here. You know, I mentioned this in the past, that I think one of the main reasons that here they show less brutality on the side of the soldiers of Easy Company is because most of them were still alive at that point. So they don't want to necessarily besmirch, the men that are helping them to make this this miniseries and tell this story. But by the time they got to the Pacific, some of the people they showed there were people that were, long gone. And if you want to be as brutally honest as possible, sometimes you have to show things. It also could be that with the Pacific, when Bruce was mapping it out, when Bruce McKenna was mapping it out, maybe he was thinking to himself, okay, we got away with a lot in Band of Brothers, and because that worked so well, we can, get away with even more here by showing the reality. Because again, the bottom line is both Band of Brothers, the Pacific, Masters of the Air, even Saving Private Ryan, and many other, they're anti-war movies or series. They're not, they're not pontificating that you need to fight a war. What they're saying here is look at the brutal hell of war and what it does to these men, and what are they all going to do in order to get beyond that?
Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, we know that a lot of the guys in Easy Company had drinking problems for the rest of their lives because of it. That was their way to cope with everything that they went through, and it was not it wasn't simple.
Yep.
So yeah. And so in the book, it actually has this same quote from Webster, but it's slightly different. So I'm just going to read it. I'm not going to try to figure out what words are being said, but it's very interesting. Because Webster wrote his own book about his time in Easy Company. So, the book Band of Brothers on page 191 has an excerpt from that. It was right after Jackson died, he just died. Over the last few days. And it says, he wasn't 20 years old, Webster wrote. He hadn't begun to live. Shrieking and moaning, he gave up his life on a stretcher. Back in America, the standard of living continued to rise. Back in America, the racetracks were booming. The nightclubs were making their greatest profits in history. Miami Beach was so crowded, you couldn't get a room anywhere. Few people seemed to care. Hell, this was a boom. This was prosperity. This was the way to fight a war. We read of black market restaurants, of a manufacturer's plea for gradual reconversion to peacetime goods beginning immediately, and we wondered if the people would ever know what it cost the soldiers in terror, bloodshed, and hideous, agonizing deaths to win the war. So, I mean, the way that Webster writes it is much more in your face than what they tell us here in, in his narration from that.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically, he only mentions here, that life was changing in America as opposed to what they say here was there was the black market and everyone was trying to find a way to step on others in order to move forward without even thinking about the fact of the cost that was being paid by the soldiers that were still fighting the war. So I like the way that I understand why they toned it down, but I think they should have kept it the same way, and then they also add in the narration here about the fact, the different places that they've been: Normandy, Bastogne, and Haguenau. So, it's nicely done the way that they put that together here. I like it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it could definitely be more explicit, like you're saying. I think it's pretty effective as it is as well. I think it's a nice sort of compromise. Probably, like what you're saying about it, maybe compromising a little bit because some of those men were still alive, as obviously, because they're all being interviewed in each episode.
Right. Oh, well, Webster wasn't. Webster, went missing in 1961, I think, something like that. So,
Yeah. Webster, but then also
for 4 years.
Yeah. But just like, I think it's a nice sort of narrative compromise. I think it hits things home without being too brutal. And that might be what someone might argue, that it's a little bit propaganda-ish to sort of tone down some of the reactions. But right. I think it works really well for TV as well.
Well, again, this is HBO, so it's not as if it's you're talking about for TV because we're watching it in parts in a miniseries, or because it's not something that's being shown in the theater. Like, what do you mean by
sort of both? Like obviously it's HBO, so they can go a lot further with things than you could on, say, like network TV, especially at the time. But even HBO at the time wouldn't necessarily go as hard as HBO goes today.
Correct.
And also just the tone of the whole thing is very reverent of American participation in World War II, and to be fair, rightly so. But I don't think it was ever going to go as deep into moral ambiguity as perhaps something like this being made today would.
Correct.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think if they made this today, that at the end of every episode, they would have like some sort of cliffhanger.
Yeah. And like people would do more, like I think the most morally questionable thing, at least in the episodes we're about to talk about, is just that there's one character who's kind of like doing some looting, you know, but there's very little in the way of like things that might potentially have been war crimes in hindsight.
Correct.
You know, that probably happened.
There's no question that it happened. And that's part of the whole idea of the stuff that they, you know, that they have glossed over in order to tell us the story in the way that they're telling it to us. I mean, even if you go all the way back to part three, you know, you see Percante shows, you know, on his arm all the watches that he's stolen off of dead German bodies. You know, that's a form of looting also, I guess you could say, even if you want to just call them souvenirs. As you said, they show these things in subtle ways. You know, and then in part nine, as you said, we will talk more about finders keepers, I guess you could say. I think it's just very effective the way that they show this. That's the bottom line.
No, it is. The whole series is very effective, and I think this is a good example of that too.
Yeah, totally agree. All right, is there anything else you want to say about this 2 minute segment that we've talked about?
No, I mean honestly, most of the interesting stuff. I think it's a nice coda to the episode, and thematically closes it up. I think one of the more interesting things in the episode happens in the 5 minutes before this, where Winters outlines a mission for the men and then tells them not to go on it.
Correct.
I think that was that's a really great little moment. And I think that more than anything, that might be, you know, that might be why he's actually, even though he sort of broke his orders, disobeyed his orders by not sending them, that is one of the things that makes him worthy of having those oak leaves. So it's an interesting combination of things he must be feeling in that moment.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Now, I mean, one of the things, I mean, we talked about this the other day, which you probably haven't heard yet, but because it hasn't dropped yet at the time of recording. But one of the things that they talk about in the book is that Sink and the other high-level commanders were all basically they had gotten some booze that day. Let's put it that way. And that was one of the reasons why Winters decided that this was the best opportune time to do that, because they'll just wake up in the morning and they're not going to know that nothing happened there during the night.
Yeah,
they all got a little too comfortable, I guess you could say. But it's
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
I like the way they do that, though. So today's segment is Band Brand, where my guests will give their top five fictional movie bands. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way?
Sure. These are not in any particular order, just because I love them all for such different reasons. But let's start with the Soggy Bottom Boys from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? The bluegrass band of that George Clooney starts with his band of outlaws as they, you know, and they record the song Man of Constant Sorrow, and they later sing In the Jailhouse Now. I think they only really have two songs, but I love both of those songs, and I love that movie, and I really love that this aspect to this telling of the Odyssey. I mean, that's Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is a pretty near perfect movie, in my opinion. And the music is a big part of that. And I do sometimes wonder what George Clooney actually sounds like. but I'm glad that I know what Tim Blake Nelson sounds like. because it's he's pretty great.
All right. Very cool.
Let's see, moving on. Let's go to a more recent one. This is it's actually a TV show, not a movie. And it's one that I was kind of surprised didn't get more. Got some pretty good critical love, but didn't get a lot of awards love. But I really love Daisy Jones and the Six, which is an okay book, but it's a great series. And if you are a fan of like 70s rock, and in particular, this Daisy Jones and the Six are a pretty obvious homage slash pastiche of Fleetwood Mac. And if you love that kind of rock, like I've listened to the album. Like they put out an album. It's a fictional band, but they put out an album of the songs from the show. And it's a great album. Like it's a solidly great album. And I think one of the great strengths is that before they started shooting the film, they spent, I can't remember, it was weeks or months, the actors just like learning their instruments and then learning to be a band before they even started filming the show. And it lends a real authenticity to the performances and to the singing, and then all the songs are bangers. So like it's a great one. I don't know if you've seen it. If you haven't, I highly
No, I
recommend
haven't
it.
seen it. But I will be
Yeah, it's
adding
like
it to my
six,
list.
it's eight episodes on Prime Video. It's definitely worth your time. And again, especially if you're into like 70s music, it's great.
Wow, that's very cool.
Yeah. Let's see here. Where should I go next? I'm gonna say another fairly recent one, and that is Sing Street from the film Sing Street, which is a band that a kid starts to impress a girl, and through the course of the movie ends up writing several amazing rock and pop songs. It's very 80s in the best way possible, but has like a wonderful ballad. They have a wonderful ballad. They have a great 80s like throwback Duran Duran derived song. They have my personal song, which is a 50s throwback called Drive It Like You Stole It. And then there's a thematic wrap-up song called Brown Shoes towards the end, which is just wonderful. The whole sequence is wonderful for both of those songs. And I think that oh wow, the guy's name has gone out of my head. But the director,
Joe
Carney,
Carney, isn't it?
John Carney.
John.
He's directed several movies. Most of them, I think all of them, are surround music in some way or another. And this is, it's easily my favorite of his films. And it, again, all the songs are bangers, and they are all thematically relevant to the story being told. Let's see, that's three. Have you seen any of these, by the way?
Sing Street, I've seen. I've seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? The only one I haven't seen is Daisy Jones and the Six so far.
Oh, okay, cool. I don't know what order to do these last two in. I'm going to actually, no, I do know. My I have a soft spot for mockumentaries about bands, and some of you probably think you know where I'm going with this because there's at least one totally classic film about a band, but I'm going to go with Dewey Cox from Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story, which is a very, very silly movie about a country pop star named Dewey Cox. It's a very obvious pastiche of Walk the Line, but also Ray. And John C. Reilly gives, I think personally, the performance, the comedy performance of his career. I never got why this film wasn't a huge hit. Although I will say that the version of the film that went to cinemas versus the director's or unrated cut you can buy on Blu-ray, the longer version is much funnier, much more complete, both in narratively and thematically. But they're both hilarious. And is another one, and this is an important point, and you might be noticing a recurring theme. All of the songs in this movie are great. Like they are, like some of them are ridiculous. Like he sings a protest song about midgets, four midgets, which is ri objectively ridiculous. But like Walk Hard, that's a great song. Guilty as Charged, that's a great song. Beautiful Ride in particular, you know, his masterpiece that sums up his entire life that he plays at the end of the movie, is a great song. And it's just a very funny movie. So it's a great movie. I wish more people would watch and appreciate. But also, like, John C. Reilly's a great singer and a great guitar player. And at one point when they were promoting the film, he went on tour as Dewey Cox, but he didn't go very many places. And if I could go back, if like time and the rules of physics were not a thing, I would go back in time and try and see him live performing some of these songs, because it's just great.
Oh wow, very cool.
Yeah. You must have seen Walk Hard, right?
Nope,
It's like 20
I
years
gotta
old
tell you
now.
that it's been on my list for a very long time, but now that you've mentioned it again, it's being bumped higher. I hope to get to it shortly.
Oh man, can't wait to see what you think of it. My heartfelt advice is to seek out the longer cut. The theatrical cut is good, but the longer cut is great. Like it's a much better film. It has a bunch of funny, like really funny gags that I think shouldn't have been cut. And there's a couple of, like, in particular, there's a like a, almost a whole decade of the story is cut out.
Oh wow, yeah,
Because
that's
it
a
takes
little bit of
place
a
from
problem.
like the 19th. Well, it's not a problem. It's like it cuts out a whole period in the 70s where Dewey Cox has songwriting block. It cuts out the meat of that story. But there's some really great stuff in the meat of that story. And also there's a couple of like recurring gags that get a few more iterations that make them way funnier. So definitely seek out the longer version.
Okay, I will do that. I will take your advice on that.
And then last but not least, from the 90s HBO TV movie, I'm going to say that I think my favorite movie band of all time is probably the Oneaters, who went on to be called The Wonders. This is a movie about a one-hit wonder. They sing a song called That Thing You Do. They also have a song that they perform in the movie called Dance With Me Tonight, which is, I think, the better of, I'm in the minority thinking it's the better of the two songs. But they are both perfect pop songs, and it is also a Tom Hanks produced and directed and written movie, so it makes it thematically on point with the show. And it is also just a great sort of underrated, like, people who know it love it, and not enough people know it, I don't think. But it's a great movie, and one more time, all the songs are great.
Right, and I mean, I'll mention this again. I mentioned it months and months ago, but that second great song from the One Hit Wonders, the Oneaters. What'd you say the name of it is? It's a love ballad, right?
So there's That Thing You Do is the
No,
main
that I
song,
know.
and then there's a pop song they perform. There's a pop song they sing called Dance With Me Tonight that's like an upbeat, like, party song. They sing it at on a round stage. I think it's
Okay,
a state fair or
friend of the
something.
show, Jim O'Kane. Actually, that was his like first dance at his wedding. The not
Oh,
that thing you
nice.
do, it's the other song. I'm trying to remember which one it is. But yeah, it's very cool. And he's yet to be on. He'll be on in a few weeks, so it'll be very interesting. My assumption is that the Oneaters will be high on his list also. I could be
Well,
wrong.
I hope
I could
so,
be
because
wrong.
they are, I mean, they're a great band. It's, again, I think they might be my favorite movie band of all time.
Okay, that's completely fair. I mean, I like them a lot, and I'm not going to reveal, whether they're going to be on my list or not, but the fact is That Thing You Do is such a great song, but it sort of does get a little annoying towards the end.
Yeah. Fair enough.
You
I would say
with
too, like, those would be my top five, but I do want to throw out honorable mentions in that I do also, like, as much as I love Dewey Cox, that whole genre of like music mockumentary, I also love Connor for Real and Spinal Tap, and it was agonizing trying to choose which one to put in the list.
Okay, that makes sense. Definitely makes sense. All right, excellent. So now we'll play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie, where the idea here is I'm going to give you hints as to what movie I have randomly chosen for you, and you have to try to figure out if you try to figure out what movie it is. All right.
All right. I did not study for this at all, like hardly at all.
Okay.
So I am expecting to be terrible at it, but
Well,
let's
we'll try
see.
it. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. Round and round and round the wheel goes. Okay, so this is a movie from 2006. It was directed by Clint Eastwood, and it is a companion piece to the movie Flags of Our Fathers.
It's Letters from Iwo
Yes, very good. You see, you didn't do so bad on that one.
Jima.
Don't know why you thought you would.
I guess for some reason I thought it would be a deeper cut. I don't know why.
You never know what you're going to get when you're back next week. That we'll have to wait and see. All
Fair
right.
enough.
Yeah. So, Matthew, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Matthew Simpson?
Yeah, the easiest way to find me is my personal portfolio website, which is stretched.ca. I do try to link all of my freelance work there. But more importantly, again, I started a new publication in the last couple of months called Northern Reel, focusing on the cinema and talent of Canadian filmmakers. And in the last, a couple of weeks, it's been really well received so far. It's been really fun to do. We've had some great film reviews. I got to interview some directors. I had a great interview with Canadian icon Colm Feore 2 weeks ago, which
Oh,
is
wow.
a great and insightful conversation about Canadian film, just ahead of an event we have in Canada called National Canadian Film Day, which he is a sponsor of. So yeah, it's been really fun. It's been really rewarding, and I hope you check it out. It's northernreel.ca.
Very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie on Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. So tomorrow I will be back with an interview episode, and Matthew will be back to join us next Tuesday. So you're gonna have to wait a few days till he's back. But until then, curry.
Hurry.